So, the animated series.
I have to say something controversial, possibly heretical, and I may be barred from your apartment forever.
I'm ready.
I think I goddamn love the animated series. If it's at all, if it's this the entire time, I'm going to be thrilled.
I don't know if it is, because I really have not ever seen much of it.
I really just hope it is, because
it's actually surprisingly pretty good.
You know, it's, in a way, it almost seems like a cartoon reenactment of what they really did.
No, it absolutely is.
And in a lot of ways, it's just kind of trippy 70s surrealistic psychedelia art with just Star Trek narration happening around it. I'm really liking that. It's just kind of a, it's, in the later seasons of Star Trek, in the third season of Star Trek, it would, the plot would be all over the place. They have to be very economical because they're on half of the time. So
yeah.
Basically, it's just kind of a series of scenes based around kind of a theme that they're doing. And again, as far as it, for what it is it as good as the best of this original series? No. I'm so far starting to really like it for what, I think it expands the universe a lot more and it makes it feel much richer.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, you know, we have to take it with a grain of salt, of course, because we were only talking about the first two episodes of the animated series. The thing I really like about the first episode we watched this week, Beyond the Farthest Star, is you're right. Like, it has to be economical in a way that the original series did not have to be as economical. And you can sort of see where they would have expanded certain things in Beyond the Farthest Star if it was a 50-minute live-action episode of the original series. But I don't think it's necessary. And, you know, it's a pretty standard Star Trek plot. They encounter a derelict ship in space and beam over. They go to the control room. The control room gets destroyed. And they beam back over to the Enterprise. And they've been...
they brought over a mean alien.
Right, exactly.
They solve it.
Yeah. And that's standard Star Trek stuff. I don't think the plot necessarily is all that interesting, but it's a lot better than a lot of the third season of the original series, number one, and it also is visually much stronger than a lot of the original series, just because they didn't have to economize, because it's animation and they can pretty much
and
it costs as much
animation as well, so in other words, they, you know, to give an art student and say, make the, you know, give an art student some acid and tell them to draw the trippiest spaceship they can think of. I mean, that's cheap as hell to do compared to actually building a set. And for the most part, it's static shots and zoom-ins and stuff like that. It doesn't even matter that, yes, if they were fully animating this, something that detailed would be prohibitive, but they're doing such limited animation that they can just put all these weird interiors or do these alien creatures just for one scene. And that's actually a lot of how it ends up being much more interesting than the third season ended up, because there's something to look at. At the very least, it looked cool.
Yeah, I mean, we have to say the animation here is not fantastic.
No.
it's passable at best. I mean, it's very much low budget, you know, 70s animation.
And yet, if you're familiar with Scott McCloud and the theory of the iconic in comics, which is, you know, something I go back to a lot, it's when something is realistic enough but not super realistic, you're able to project yourself onto it a bit easier. And so I find that the art style helps me kind of imagine what it really looks like in a way.
Yeah.
So I see this drawing of this spaceship. Well, in my mind, it's going to look much cooler and much stranger than that. And which, if they were doing in a live action series, even the best prop will still look a bit, especially for that era and that budget, there will be seams.
And I think it's interesting, too, because they really did try, as little as this had a budget, they really did try to get the feel of the original series, to get the look of the characters down, to get the look of the costuming, and to really make it, you know, feel as realistic as possible. I mean, this is not the Flintstones, right? This is definitely a more realistic version of a cartoon. And
if this was in one of those trends with the, you know, Gilligan's Island, the cartoon, and all of that stuff, the Harlem Globetrotters cartoon, which was one of, I don't know, the 70s had such shitty animation, but in a context like this, I'm finding it kind of delightful. It feels like a best of the series in a way.
Yeah.
They cut away the fat, and yet it is weird. The pacing of this episode is fairly off. Like, this beginning when they're having this long countdown, they could have cut that into a, you know, 15-second sequence and then given me more of the backstory of this villain that they had, for example.
I think it's interesting because it really is Star Trek boiled down to its essence in this episode. And you're right. There is parts of it that could have been cut. Parts of it are definitely flabby. Even at the, I mean, this was 24 minutes long or 25 minutes long, and a minute is taken up with opening credits and ending credits. So really it's 23 minutes long. And that's less than half of what the original series episodes were. But at the same time, the pacing still does feel a little off. I wonder, though, if that is just because they, you know, this was written by Samuel Peeples, who wrote a couple episodes of the original series. And, you know, I just wonder if that is him not understanding how to write a Star Trek story for this time period, or time frame, I mean.
And specifically for this audience, because watching this show, the people who are watching this are kids and, like, stoned nerds. So
I'm actually not sure about that. I mean, I don't...
It feels like you just want to give... I mean, they do, given the psychedelic art, and given that there are a lot of explosions in some parts of this, like, they do give some action sequences, and I think if they had front-loaded those a bit more... realized what this was, this, while you do want to have a sophisticated series, while this is the child of Star Trek, maybe give something that, you know, the 12 through 14 year olds would find sophisticated. So in other words, it will still give all of the messages of Star Trek, but tailored to a younger palette. That's kind of what I figured would make a bit more sense.
It's interesting because this definitely was a Saturday morning cartoon. I don't know how many children were actually watching this.
Yeah, I don't know.
And, you know, I've seen interviews with, you know, DC Fontana, for example, where, you know, she said that they expected children to watch, but a lot of the reviews of the animated series basically made a point of saying, I don't think children are going to watch this. This is a very adult cartoon. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, you don't want to overstate it because the animated series was basically a failure. We only have 22 episodes of it. And but at the same time, you know, animation wasn't seen as something for adults.
Well, that's exactly
until the 80s and 90s. So
Simpsons was really the first cartoon, that adults watched and could watch seriously. And so...
I mean, I
think if they had made the animated series again,
I could
pitch it to young teenagers and, you know, completely create it for that, give a bit more of a, I think it might have been more of a success with that demographic because, yes, the young teenagers were watching Star Trek anyway, so,
yeah,
you know, and just give them a little cooler stuff to work with, it would, I think that would have been more successful than this, which is the one thing I will say is it's not sure who it's audiences.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, I think if it, you know, I could definitely see a version of this show that had a higher animation budget that looked a lot better with the quality of the scripts that we're getting, because they're, I mean, the two episodes we watched, Beyond the Farthest Star and later on we'll talk about Yesteryear, are very good. And
could
I mean, I think
you could use a slight scrub, the first one more so, but
I think Yesteryear could rank up with you know, in the if we're talking about top tier original series episodes, it could definitely rank up there with it.
We'll talk about that one in a second, but...
You know, so you know, leaving aside sort of the meta stuff about the animated series...
Which I figure we'll go through as we notice more and more things.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to watch, I think, the evolution of the show. And once, because the animated series had a 16-episode first season and only a 6-episode second season.
Oh, so it's considered two seasons. Okay.
It is considered two seasons, and I'll be curious to see how the show evolves and if it even does evolve and what the second season looks like. But you know, talking specifically about Beyond the Farthest Star, like we said, it's a standard Star Trek plot. There's nothing really new here. But I do like the fact that they really try and, you know, keep the tone of the show, keep the tone of the characters. And the alien ship, I think, is an interesting concept that they probably would have gone into a little bit more if this had been a full 50-minute episode of the show.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a couple more rooms because, again, I was really enjoying that, but...
I like the life support belts that they have, which were basically
glowy halo thing. That's
That was basically just a very cheap way for them to get out of drawing suits. And you know, they could basically use the same animation, just put on this, you know, halo thing on the plates. And the other thing I like about the episode too is It's very economical. It's very compact. And the ending of the episode, I find very sad in a weird way.
That's
something that I don't think the original series really did. It kind of gave a little bit more of a personality to this evil alien presence that was taking over the Enterprise.
Well, it's funny because I remember Who Moins Fred and I. So we have, the Apollo character is, at the end they're trying to say, yes, it's really sad that these gods passed away from this world. And it's like, no, you don't say that after you killed the guy, I think that was, what I said about that. And I didn't feel that it earned the poignancy, even though Apollo was a much better characterized villain. In this episode, now, even though the villain is just doing the Jacob Marley, Captain Kirk. And
he sounds like a Dalek, actually, which is strange.
I'm sure that was the voice is used in Yesteryear. I have a feeling this will be the generic evil, monster voice.
So I will give you some background on that. So it's a slightly different voice. I think the alien in Beyond the Farthest Star, it doesn't sound like the Guardian of Forever in Yesteryear. It's a Dalek, and then in Yesteryear, it's that Jacob Marley sort of ghost voice.
Yeah, it's
played by James Doohan.
Really?
Yeah, he did most of the male voices in the show. Because the thing about the original series is that they really had to work hard to get all of the original series cast. They weren't originally going to have Uhura or Sulu in the show.
Okay.
And they made a point of making sure that they had those characters in the show with the original voices. And, just because of the budget that the show had, Majel Roddenberry did most of the female guest star voices, and James Doohan did most of the male guest star voices.
But if in both cases they can do
absolutely
multiple voices, they'll take a bigger paycheck and it'll save the studio money either way. Makes sense. That's common. At the very end, they kind of trick this creature, this presence, I think Netflix calls it a parasitic alien or something like that. Anyway, into staying on this planet and essentially possessing it and essentially being completely abandoned. And as they're going, it's saying, how lonely it is. And it's very strange because I can't figure out how exactly they do that, but they just suddenly make you feel really sorry for this guy,
And I do have to say, I think a lot of it is due to James Doohan's performance of the alien.
That might be, yeah. Again, as evil as it was, it reminds me of, they've done this a few times before, the Trelane episode, where it's kind of this just lonely kid, who doesn't really know any better. This one seems like a little an entity that this is all it does. It can't really survive anyway, but it is lonely as hell. It kills what it loves.
Yeah.
Oh, god damn. No, and it's one of those, it was a cheesy, cheap 70s TV show, but it seems like there were people on board who cared.
Yeah.
They didn't. And I guess maybe that's it. The third season didn't seem like they cared. Now it seemed like they're not going to do a good job because of outside factors, but there is a heart to it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because, again, there were writers on the show that were working on it that had worked on the original series at its, height. And they really did, they really did try and make the best Star Trek that they could.
And you know what? I'm sure probably by the end there were so many scripts they submitted which, we can't do that because of budget. We can't put this on the show. We can't, And so now they don't have that.
I find, the one thing I do like about the episode probably the most is I do like the idea that as they make a point of saying that the ship is more advanced than anything that they've ever seen before. And they find this log entry from the commander or whatever. And it's great because it's an alien that you just could not do well in a live action, original series.
You would see the rubber mask, but they don't have the building. Yeah.
Right. And the implication there is that they could not figure out a way to get rid of the alien. And so they had to destroy their own ship. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, of course, that they all died, but the alien was still alive. I like the idea that even though they make a point of saying that the ship is so much more advanced than anything that they've seen in the Federation, that Kirk and Spock and the crew figure out a way pretty quickly to dispatch the alien. And so it really speaks to, I think, a lot of the qualities of the original series where your technology level doesn't matter so much. It's your skill and your intelligence that matters.
Well, you see, what I thought you were going to point out, which I thought was hilarious, was how something 3 million years past could, or whatever, could even be, how the hell do you figure out that computer? You know what I mean? Like, it's hard enough to figure out an 80s operating system at that point. I thought that was hilarious. Like, that's a little too convenient. Spock isn't that good.
Well, you know, I mean, you have to get there somehow. So it didn't really bother me that much.
That being said, it is funny to watch things like that.
Yeah, I would say. Yeah. But no, I think, you know,
it has a charm to it.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I'm definitely liking it in that respect so far.
Oh no.
You know, it has a heart to it, and I think the ending has a heart to it, and the way that they figure out how to defeat the alien has a heart to it, and it really speaks to the best of the original series, even though it's certainly not as good as many of the original series episodes. And I don't think we're talking about like a lost classic here, but it's definitely watchable and it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, I get the feeling that at the end of the day, maybe if we, you know, one could compile a list that lops off a half to a third of original series episodes, but adds in some animated series, and you've got a really good solid chunk of about, you know, 40 or 50 episodes.
The other thing I want to mention, and then we'll move on to Yesteryear, is Lieutenant Kyle appears in this episode as the transporter guy. And he's growing a handlebar mustache.
Yeah, well, it was the 70s.
Okay, fine.
My favorite part was when they're cutting this pipe and it falls down and it makes the sound when Scooby and Shaggy crash into each other.
Yeah, that was the sound effect from the Flintstones, actually.
Yeah, like...
It's stuff like that.
No,
I mean,
but it's stuff like that makes it crummy, but in a very, like, Ed Wood charming way. Again, if you like animation, you're going to like animation like this, because again, the parts that are inept almost are excusable, considering when they show this ship, when they show this alien, that's, it's worth it. It's so I'm liking this. I'm shocked.
All right, well, let's move on to our second episode, Yesteryear. So surprisingly, the second episode of the animated series, I think, is really good.
It's
amazingly good.
I don't want to
oversell it, because of course you have to take it with a grain of salt. As we just said, you know, in the previous segment, the animation isn't great and the production quality is not great, but this is a damn fine episode.
Let me put it this way. Put this at the production level of, and what is the Ponfar episode called? I always forget.
Amok Time.
Amok Time. Put this with the same production level as Amok Time and make this a regular episode. It would probably be one of the best. Give it that same level. Again, this is DC Fontana writing, so you do have that, you know, a script from her will always be good. It has to be clipped and economical, obviously. Give her another 20 minutes, half hour with this, and I think this would have been a very good episode.
Yeah. So there's some continuity here. We have the Guardian of Forever coming back.
Guardian of Forever, that was it.
But they don't call it that for some reason.
They don't mention the name. I think at one point they very, you know, they say the Guardian, but they don't really go into it, I guess, because... But I kind of liked that, because they wouldn't... It came as a little. I've seen that. I know what that is. You know. And if you've never seen it,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
really,
you just
what
know
it's called.
It's a time travel device.
Yeah. So it's great, because you know they set it up as they're going back to examine civilizations in the past, and Kirk and Spock jump out of the Guardian of Forever, and everyone's like, "Who the hell is Spock? Why is he with you?" So it turns out that something happened, and Spock has to go back in time to when he was a child and save himself.
Now, I just want to say this actually resolves kind of a question I had from the original series. You have these things such as the Guardian and Forever that are never mentioned again. This is showing, oh no, in the background, they actually really, you know, Kirk reported and they figured, hey, this is massively useful. You know, it's just Kirk never dealt with that. That fleshes it out, makes it seem like the Federation isn't a bunch of, you know, people with short memories.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it gives a continuity to it, as you said.
Yeah. It's funny, because again, they set it up very economically, and I think a lot of what happens in the first, you know, 5 minutes of the episode with Kirk and Spock walking around trying to figure out what's going on, and you have another first officer on the Enterprise, Commander Thalen.
And what is that alien?
An Andorian.
An Andorian, another continuity.
There's a Birdman.
Yeah, what is that guy? Which they never could have done on the original series, but...
I don't know. I don't think they ever appear again.
But again, that's one of the strengths of this series. They can make it seem like then Starfleet is this, you know, there are all aliens coming in and out. I would assume we will probably see more.
Yeah, we definitely see more aliens. It's funny because if you noticed the alien on the bridge yet.
Yeah, like that four-armed guy?
Yeah, yeah. Like that's, I think, I forget his name. I think it's Rex or something.
But he becomes a regular.
Arex, maybe? Anyway. Yeah, I think he, I don't know he that much about the like animated series. So
yet, I don't think.
I think he does become sort of a character in the show.
Yeah.
Also, the animated series, no Chekhov.
Yes.
At all. They couldn't afford Walter Koenig. So.
Why was he in that in demand?
Well, the show, you know, they had to really fight to pay Nichelle Nichols and James Doohan. So
No. Maybe it was a thing where, you know, Walter Koenig went up. He's like, guys, we can't afford to pay. No. I'll do it for really cheap. But no, we really just can't afford to pay you. No. I'll work for almost. We can't afford you, Walter. Just please. Here is a nickel. Don't buy yourself a cup of coffee and get a shower. You look like hell. You know, that's probably what happened.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be. I think the episode really picks up once Spock figures out what happens and goes back in time.
Because then you have these great shots of Vulcan. You have this city. You have
we get to see what Vulcan looks like. We get to see a Vulcan city.
Again, they can go very alien,
and it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a very mannered sort of architecture.
Yeah.
It's very polite, even. It feels,
but very artistic and beautiful and very geometric and mathematical looking too.
And I like the fact that, you know, Vulcan is also portrayed as a very dangerous planet.
Yeah, it's like it's a death world.
Yeah,
out there.
Like there's
it's Australia.
There's giant lizards with poison claws, and there's these weird like sucker plants that come up from the ground. And you know,
those bear things, he talks about them, right?
His pet Salak.
That was
mentioned
in one of the episodes.
In Journey to Babel.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, this episode is almost a direct follow-up to Journey to Babel. Because, of course, Journey to Babel was the episode where we first meet Spock's parents, Sarek and Amanda. And get a little bit more background on Spock, why he is the way he is, sort of the relationship that he has with his mother and father. And
we get to see who they are in their home, you know, as opposed to when they're on official business.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen some. I remember I loved their interactions in private in that episode, you know, the way that Sarek is affectionate towards his wife, but in very tiny, subtle ways that only she realizes. But yeah, to see the two ways that they do both appreciate Spock and, you know, was very interesting. The ways that, I don't know, I did not expect the show to have an episode like this.
Well, I like it because, you know, you really do get a sense of Spock as a child, where he comes from, and actually seeing it completely makes sense, because there's that great scene in the beginning where he's being bullied by other Vulcan children and they're calling him like Earther and stuff.
Yeah.
And that was actually like directly picked up by J.J. Abrams for Star Trek movie.
Pretty much the same scene.
Right, exactly. And then, of course, Amanda is shown as caring about her son, but kind of being a little bit standoffish because of her. You know, she's living on Vulcan. She's married to a Vulcan. She has a half Vulcan son. So there's almost this like you can. I mean, it's very difficult to know how much of this is me projecting this and how much is actually in the episode. But I really do get a sense that, you know, she feels very protective, but she also knows that she needs to act a different way than she would if this was a human child.
Well, I have to say, at the end of the episode, when, you know, Spock says, "Oh, I am going to follow the Vulcan way," they do this. She just gets this facial expression. She just like closes her eyes and turns her head, and it's actually a very subtly drawn, where it's just she's at the same time upset and, you know, proud, and she understands and she knows it's her, you know, it's her both letting it's her feeling that, you know, this is the moment when he is becoming an adult and starting to detach, and, you know, she has all these mixed emotions. Again, to find that in a cartoon, a 70s cartoon, was surprising.
And the other thing I like about it too is Spock's relationship, the adult Spock's relationship with, you know, Sarek of the past, because he pretends to be a distant cousin and they have this very, of course, formal Vulcan relationship in the episode. But at the same time, You can kind of see Spock not needling Sarek, but kind of subtly pointing him towards maybe accepting his son a little bit more on his own terms.
And in a way which it does completely make sense. Obviously, Spock is going to know the best way of dealing with baby Spock. And, you know,
who is dressed like He-Man, by the way.
I really don't feel comfortable talking about the outfit, so I'm just going to leave it at that. All adult Spock looks kind of sexy in that robe, but that's all I will say. All
right.
And I love the way that Spock interacts with his younger self, where he basically does, you know, forces him to face these decisions, you know, but asks him in a way that will most, you know, like be receptive, you know, when he's saying, you know, you have to make a decision. Here's the information, you know. He shows him how to do a nerve pinch, which he couldn't do. I liked that.
And of course, you know, once the young Spock runs away and adult Spock has to go after him, you know, we don't get any scenes of Sarek and Amanda together really alone, except for that one scene. I would have liked to maybe had seen a scene with them discovering that young Spock had been is not in the house and where is he? You know, that would have been interesting.
Yeah,
to see.
Do have one. Well. No, they didn't when they find out that both of them are gone and they're saying, you know, you wouldn't think that. You know,
oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, there was one. I forgot about that because that was a great scene where earlier on in the episode, Sarek says that there's no crime on Vulcan. And then later on, Amanda says, you don't think that he would hurt Spock.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if there's no crime on Vulcan, then why would he hurt Spock? But anyway.
Hang on, because I'm trying to think. Yeah, I don't know. That may have just been one of those, you know.
Things. And you know, once we get to the real meat of the episode, which is what happens in the desert to cause Spock to decide to go with his Vulcan heritage as opposed to his human heritage.
Wait, actually, it does completely make sense that they would worry about him hurting them because Vulcans do have emotions; they just don't really show them. No matter how Vulcan Sarek is, you know, if his son's life is in danger, perhaps he would be that worried that he would not trust adult Spock.
Yeah, maybe.
Does that make sense or does that too stretchy?
No, I think it makes sense. But, okay. You know, it's one of those things that really is not. I mean,
but they're fun to do, Eric.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I do like the fact that it's nicely bookended, right? Because you have young Spock deciding to suppress his emotions and totally go over to logic. And, you know, make the hard choice, because what happens in the episode is that his pet Saylad, who was adorable, by the way, Ichara, you know, helps him, follows him out there, helps when Spock is attacked by a wild animal in the desert. And then, of course, the sad thing happens where Ichara is hit by the claws and is poisoned and Spock has to go run and find a vet, basically.
Yeah.
And at the very end of the episode, it's revealed that it's been too late and he has to make the choice that either he's going to let his pet die in pain or euthanize him. And he makes the choice. And I mean, you know, and as for a 6-year-old child, that's a pretty heavy thing to have to decide.
And by the way, wasn't that a devastating cut? Like, they show the doctor, like, take a syringe out of his toolkit, and then they just fade cut to he's at home and talking to his parents.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was,
and it's interesting because
heart-wrenching.
You know, the actor who plays young Spock, I mean, he's a child actor
from
1973,
because
so, you know, whatever. I mean, it's like,
I expected him to tell the story of Jesus's birth at one point.
But it's just, you know, little things where the way that his face is drawn in the episode, where he seems a little bit more emotional, a little on edge in the beginning part of the episode. And then you're right, after that cut, he's talking to his father and he's very flat and he's very unemotional. And he's, even his face is blank. And I think this is where you really see the adult Spock starting to form, mm-hmm. where Spock is not just a Vulcan. He has to be a super Vulcan and he can't show any emotion ever.
And I loved that the, you know, at one point Sarek says, you know, you people can fail this test, you know, there's no shame in that. But if you fail that, they're going to blame it on the Earth part and say, you know, you don't have the leeway to fuck up because who you are, everybody is watching you. And that was a that's a difficult concept for the show to deal with.
No, absolutely. And then, of course, towards the very end of the episode, when the last scene that adult Spock has with young Spock, where he's telling himself as a child, you know, look, Vulcans do have emotions.
Yeah.
And they have emotions that are perhaps even stronger than humans. But it's just that the serenity of logic provides a way for life to progress. You know, it and there's that great line that Sarek says as well, where he says, look, you know, the Vulcan way is very, very difficult, but look at what it gives us. It gives us a planet with no war. It gives us a planet with no crime. It allows us to live a life that is very, very good if you put in the time and effort to do it. And it's nicely bookended at the end when Spock has that conversation with himself, where he's saying, look, yeah, we do have emotions, but you need to decide which way you're going to go. Yeah, there's a nice thing here.
There is the emotions are a price for living in a place that looks this cool, frankly. And you have, I think it's interesting how there is that dramatic within the planet itself. You have this ordered city where there is no crime, and you have the outskirts where everything is trying to kill you. So that's the logic, is that logic is a bastion against the dark. It makes sense that they would need to create a philosophy that can deal with it.
And I also think it makes sense just on a structural level as well, because, you know, Vulcan probably doesn't have any suburbs, right? Because, you know, if you're a logical Vulcan, you're going to design a city that protects its citizens from the outside elements and outside animals, going to build a wall, and you're not going to go outside of there, really.
Like, they probably have the best subway system ever.
Right.
Like, they all of their districts are really efficiently, like, their schools are very perfectly dotted and everything like that. They have the right amount of libraries. Good old Vulcan.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have the last line that adult Spock says to Sarek, where he says, try and understand your son. And it's like, oh, that's just... gets you right in the heart. Like, that's, you know, because it's such a nice postscript to Journey to Babel, and it really does put a nice capper on that relationship and on Spock, and colors a lot of how Spock has developed.
And what I would think is that,
and Sarek too,
I think it would also give Spock a different appreciation for his father, having to see what child Spock was like. At this point, adult Spock has fully embraced, you know, the tenets of logic, but that was, you know, he fully admits that this period of time, his memory is, you know, a little fuzzy.
Since, sure.
You know, I was a child at that point, you know, it was half remembered stuff. So he may not have remembered how emotional he was. And so it gives him an appreciation for how this, you know, how his father felt when his son was not fully following the philosophy of logic. I thought that was very nice. I mean, this entire episode felt like... This is obviously because people had questions about Vulcan, because how cool was Vulcan in the times, you know, we've seen of it already.
I don't even think it was people. I think it was DC Fontana.
Well, you know what? I'm sure that, you know, people, you know, fans at this point... The convention had happened at this point, right?
Yeah, it did, yeah.
People had probably asked, you know, questions about Vulcan, or had sent in, you know, letters to the show.
And of course, you know, I was reading in this interview with DC Fontana where she said that, you know, we could only show a very small portion of the planet of Vulcan in Amok time, that sort of ceremonial area, just because of the budgetary constraints. And she really wanted to, you know, once she knew the animated series was happening and she was going to write episodes for it. And I think this was the only episode she wrote for the animated series, unfortunately. Yeah, but it's a really good one.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see her redeem herself after, you know, some of the episodes that she wrote in the third season, which weren't super great, but they were all right.
This was stuff that she either had known about or just, you know, suddenly became curious about. You
and
know?
That,
what,
you know,
what was Spock as a child?
Right, and Spock was always one of her favorite characters to write for, and so when she was presented with the opportunity to show Vulcan... without any budgetary constraints, really, she went for it.
And she did a really good job.
Yeah.
Like I said, I would be very happy if this series is just a series of death worlds like this and trippy art, but this was a very good episode. Again, if this had been a mid-season 2 original series episode, this would be one of the classics.
Absolutely, yeah. We didn't rate Beyond the Farthest Star.
No, but we should give them, like, what was, like, the berry creature called?
The berry creature?
The berry.
A Saylat?
The Saylat.
Okay, let's give them Saylats.
Okay, the first one gets out of 10?
Sure.
Okay. I would say that's a 7. Selat, this is an 8.5.
Okay, I'll give the first one 5, and this one gets a 9.
Wow.
I like this one a lot.
I can see why. Yeah, no, this is, especially if you love Spock.
Yeah.
Because this is just, hey, let's talk about Spock.
So next week, we are going to talk about one of our planets is missing and the Lorelei signal.
Oh my God, like from Gilmore Girls?
Maybe.